Well, hey, ready or not, Christmas is upon us. I know as I say that, there are probably as many reactions to that statement as there are people in the room this morning. For some, this is a time of year to be survived. And for others, it's the most wonderful time of the year. Some of you are looking forward to multiple family gatherings. Others have multiple family gatherings that you're not looking forward to. Others maybe wish you had family gatherings to go to. For some, Christmas is associated with warm emotions. For others, it digs up memories you'd rather keep buried. Christmas is not one size fits all. Now, for the most part, I personally enjoy the Christmas season. I have a couple little pet peeves, and admittedly, they're very minor things. I'm not putting these as any kind of great areas of crisis. First, weeks of Christmas music everywhere. I mean, the 25th, sure, that's Christmas. And fine, I can compromise. The 24th, go ahead and play your Christmas music. But multiple weeks of seasonal music just about drives me crazy. And the whole shopping thing. I mean, I'm a terrible shopper to begin with. Christmas shopping just is that much worse. Between crowded stores and then my inevitable panic purchasing of gifts that don't turn out to be as good on the 25th as they were when I was in the checkout line with them on the 24th. I mean, that's stress. Others of you here have already started playing Christmas music and love holiday shopping. I don't get you, but we're still brothers and sisters in Christ. In so many ways, I think Christmas is a matter of perspective, and not just for us. I think of the whole cast of characters in the Bible who are somehow tied to the Christmas story, and I'm sure they each had a very unique perspective on the meaning of that event and how it impacted them. And we want to try and tap into some of that as we move through the Advent season this year in a series that we're calling Christmas in Perspective. Steve and I are going to teach through this series together, and what we want to try and do is share with you the point of view of four characters associated in some way with the Christmas story, and we're gonna try and do that from a first-person perspective. Now, I had kind of wanted to go another step further yet and have Steve and I do it in costume as well, mostly because Steve has picked Mary as one of his characters, and I wanted to see how he'd handle that. We've decided against that. Still, we're gonna present in the first person as a way to try and see if we can transport you into the perspective of the character that we're presenting, and I hope it works. If it does, please thank me later. If not, it was Steve's idea. I want to get things started today by imagining the perspective of a prophet who has significant ties to the Christmas event, and that is the prophet Isaiah. The background of my monologue this morning will include a number of texts, but primarily, if you want to know where I'm getting the bulk of my material, it's Isaiah 7, 1 to 17. If you're part of a life group and you work through the life challenge material, you'll actually read that through this week and have a chance to dialogue about it. Now, I'm going to ask your indulgence a little bit this morning as well to give me creative license on the time frame that I'm going to cover. While Isaiah's own time period will make up the bulk of my perspective this morning, I will jump ahead towards the end of my sharing to make explicit ties to the Christmas story. To be clear, Isaiah was long dead by the time Christmas came around. Long dead. But I'm going to imagine how Isaiah might reflect on the birth of Jesus if he had been around for hundreds of years and had witnessed the event. And so without further ado, I welcome you to consider the meaning of Christmas from the perspective of the prophet Isaiah. It was the year King Uzziah died. I remember it clearly because in my time, the death of a king brought about it with it a lot of uncertainty and a lot of worry. I've heard that in a democracy, potential leaders get to actually make their case to the citizens for why they should be allowed to lead, and then the people actually decide, not us. The king dies, and we cross our fingers to hope something good might happen next. Which son will be the king? What will he be like? Will it be a peaceful transition to the throne, or will there literally be war? Maybe most worrisome, Will one of our neighbors try and swoop in while there is a leadership gap and defeat us? The year the king dies brings with it lots of questions and lots of fear. In the middle of this uncertainty, I had a vision of God himself. And let me tell you, there is nothing as awesome and fearful as a vision of Almighty God. In the vision, God asked a question: who shall I send, and who will go for us? I put up my hand and I responded, here I am, send me. As I think back, I'm not sure if I thought before I spoke or if I just blurted it out. Whatever the motivation, I had put myself out there, and God wasted no time taking me up on the offer. He gave me a clear commission to speak his word, be his messenger to the people. Regardless of whether I had really thought this through, I had now been sent, and when God sends you, you don't argue. Unless your name is Moses, but that's a different story. Well, the question of power transition settled out okay in the end. Jotham, Uzziah's son, who had actually been ruling with his dad for a time, was next in line to the throne. And for the most part, he was a good king. Jotham's son, Ahaz, well, that was a whole different matter. That was a transition of power that turned out not so good. Ahaz would go down in history as one of our most apostate kings ever. Try and be a prophet in that kind of environment. It's the worst. Still, when God is your direct supervisor, you listen. I remember clearly one particular season during Ahaz's reign in which there was a threat from our neighbors to the north. There was a plot brewing involving Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel. I was, of course, living in the southern kingdom of Judah. The plot essentially centered around trying to oust Ahaz from the throne and replace him with the son of Tabeel. Now, a political and military threat is bad enough to begin with. But when one of the co-conspirators is your own flesh and blood, kind of adds insult to injury, and it's a reminder of how divided a people we really were. Well, it was with that threat hanging over the nation that God sent me to give a message to Ahaz. There were a couple parts to God's instruction. First, God told me not to go alone. I was specifically told to take my son with me. Now, one of the downsides to being a prophet is that sometimes you don't get the joy of naming your own kids. Sometimes God decides for you, and between you and I, frankly, his names aren't always all that great. My wife and I decided to call our son David after one of the great rulers from our past. God came along and overrode that decision, saying his name should be Sha'ar Yashuv. It means a remnant shall return. Wasn't my first choice. Wasn't my second choice. But again, when God speaks, it's best to do what he says. And so as a remnant shall return and I were heading to see the king, it dawned on me that maybe his name had something to do with God turning this meeting with the king into take your kid to work day. Now, while there are some downsides to the job, being a prophet also has some perks. While the name thing is a tad annoying, on the upside, sometimes you get inside information other people don't get. In this case, God was kind enough to give me Ahaz's GPS coordinates, which saved me from having to ask around or waste time traipsing through the city to try and find where this guy was. God said Ahaz was at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the area of the highway that goes to Fuller's Field. As soon as God told me that, I started putting a few pieces together. The only plausible reason I could think of for why the king would be at the conduit of the upper pool was to personally inspect and assess our city's water supply, which was admittedly somewhat vulnerable. Clearly, Ahaz was feeling nervous about this threat to the north. It was weighing heavily on him. You see, a besieged city with proper fortifications can last a long time, as long as there is food and water inside the walls. Ahaz wasn't so sure the city was in great shape from that perspective. And frankly, he wasn't wrong about that. Sure enough, I found Ahaz exactly where God told me I would. And I delivered the message, which in a nutshell to begin with was, be firm and calm. Do not be afraid. And do not lose heart. See, Ahaz, it turns out, was already working out his own solution to the threat from the north. He was already calculating the possibility of a political alliance with the superpower, Assyria, as his way of getting out of this mess. God had sent me to talk him out of doing that. The message from God to Ahaz that I delivered went on to assure him that the coalition formed against him would not stand. Syria and the northern kingdom were, I said, smoldering stumps. All smoke, no fire. What God wanted Ahaz to do in the face of this threat was, well, nothing. Ahaz wasn't supposed to do anything. Well, let me rephrase that. Not nothing, nothing. Ahaz wasn't supposed to come up with his own solution to the threat. What he was supposed to do was stand firm in faith. Faith. Hardly seemed like a great strategy when your opponents are actively working to take your throne. The natural thing to do would be exactly what Ahaz was doing. Fortify the city. Be ready to defend yourself. Use all your political acumen to outmaneuver your opponent. God wanted Ahaz to stop doing all those things. God would save our nation, and not by means of some astute political maneuvering or military might. And so I said to Ahaz, on God's behalf, if you don't stand firm in your faith, you shall not stand at all. If you don't stand firm, you will not remain firm. Ahaz, no faith, no future. No faith, no future. As I finished delivering my message to Ahaz, there was this moment of awkward silence. I wasn't sure what to make of it, though I noticed Ahaz's eyes shifted to look now not at me but at my son. I wondered what was running through his mind as his eyes were locked on "A Remnant Shall Return." Maybe God sending him with me was God's way of putting Ahaz on notice that the stakes for the decision he was about to make were very high. A remnant returning presupposed a defeat and being carried away into exile. Maybe Ahaz was beginning to understand the gravity of the decision that lay ahead of him. See, the fact is that any good member of the house of Judah should have been quick to trust God. We had a great promise to hold on to, after all. Ahaz was sitting on the throne of King David, to whom God had made a substantial promise long ago. God said, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the Son of Man, but my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. You see, in the midst of this crisis, my word to Ahaz was an invitation from God to not fix his heart on the pressing concrete crisis, but instead to set his heart on the promise of God to his family and to his throne. Not that God necessarily wanted us to all be sitting on our hands, but we were supposed to rest secure in God's promise of steadfast love and loyalty towards us. The choice Ahaz had was to decide if he was going to recognize that we were the people of God, defined by the promises of God, or if he was going to act as though we were simply another political entity defined by his kingship. Well, the look on Ahaz's face told me that his willingness to stand on the promise of God was not very high. In the silence of that moment, God gave me another word for Ahaz, which I faithfully put to him. On behalf of God, I offered Ahaz an opportunity for my message to be validated. Ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. It was a pretty generous offer, if I do say so myself. God was inviting Ahaz to have some sort of proof to help him choose the road of faith. I was very curious how Ahaz would respond. God had offered him that he could ask for anything, anything. Yet for all I imagined, how he did respond was not on my radar at all. Ahaz said this, he said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. Didn't see that coming. I admit my initial response was to be somewhat impressed. I mean, let's be honest. As a person, Ahaz was no paragon of virtue. Yet this refusal to ask because he didn't want to test God seemed so surprisingly mature to me. But then it hit me. Ahaz was just feigning spirituality. It was a ruse to mask what was actually stubborn unbelief and hypocrisy. See, Ahaz had already determined in his heart that he would follow through with his own plan and trust his own political scheming instead of faith in the promise of God. And this was just his way of trying to get God off his back. He wanted to be done dealing with God. God, knowing the heart of Ahaz, didn't back down. He told me to let Ahaz know that he was getting a sign, whether he liked it or not, which I did. And I'm guessing by my tone and the word choice that Ahaz knew neither God or I were terribly impressed with him. Hear then, O house of David, I said. Is it too little for you to weary mortals that you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young woman, let me just stop here for a second because I get asked this all the time and I want to preempt your question. Everyone who hears me tell the story, they all ask the same thing. Who is the young woman? Well, my smart aleck response is usually to say that if I wanted you to know who she was, don't you think I would have told you her name in the first place? I know, some wonder, is this a reference to my wife or a consort of Ahaz? You folks spin all kinds of theories. Look, even if I wanted to tell you, frankly, privacy laws forbid me from giving her name. In the end, all that mattered is that Ahaz knew exactly who I was talking about. The young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey by the time he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. Presumably, Ahaz would say nothing to this young woman about the prophecy I had given him. That would sort of defeat the purpose of this being a sign from God. But this mother, naming her child Emmanuel, with no one giving her a hint of what I had said to the king, would be proof to him that he could trust the message I had given, that it was from God. And the fact that before this child who would know how to distinguish between good and evil, that the threat from the north would be totally gone, meant this was not an indefinite promise in terms of time frame. Now, of course, depending which parent you talk to, you'll get a variety of opinions of how old it takes a kid to be before they know the difference between good and evil. I get that. But the bottom line is, this wasn't open-ended. We would see the sign confirmed. Well, like my son, this child's name was no mere random choice. God was sending a message to Ahaz loud and clear. The name Emmanuel means God is with us. God is with us. That was the message God wanted Ahaz to hear. God was with him. God was with us. We were his people. And even if nothing else was certain, that truth was to be enough for us to confidently stand in faith. God was with us, present to do for us what Ahaz couldn't do for us. The Emmanuel child was God's visible, physical, concrete reassurance that he was here as our defender and as our guardian, as our protector. God wasn't expecting that we would deny the reality of the threat and danger. What he was saying is that in the face of the threat and danger, this child was a sign that the danger had no teeth. If we would only stand in faith. Well, in the end, Isaiah chose not to trust. Ahaz chose not to trust. He put confidence in himself, in his own smarts, in his own strength, rather than the promise of God. He chose to live life absent of the faith that the God with us child was supposed to awaken in him. He chose to carry out his ill-advised policy of turning to the Assyrians for help. And the irony of it all is that indeed the alliance with the Assyrians was good for our kingdom so far as the threat from Syria and the northern kingdom was concerned, but it was short-term gain for long-term pain. Aligning with Syria came at a massive cost. Financially, it was expensive. It cost the sum total of the treasury of both our temple and our palace. And beyond that, I mean, who are we kidding? This was no mere alliance of equals. Ahaz wrote to the king of Assyria, referring to himself as the king's servant and son, which is just diplomatic language indicating voluntary submission to the Assyrians. In the end, the very people Ahaz turned to for help in his brilliant strategy became the very people who took both our wealth and our independence. No faith, no future, I said to Ahaz. Turned out once again, God's word was spot on. Little did I know that hundreds of years later, an angel would make reference to my encounter with Ahaz that day at the city water supply. The angel would appear to a man named Joseph, telling him that his bride-to-be would have a baby boy and that he would be called Emmanuel. The person who wrote the story down even mentioned me. Well, I mean, not by name, but he mentioned the word God spoke through the prophet, and just so there's no mistaking, that is me. It's not simply by chance that the angel told my story. It wasn't just the words of my proclamation he was borrowing. It was the heart of my message. The meaning of what God told me to say to Ahaz, that call to stand in faith hundreds of years earlier, was the meaning the angel was declaring to Joseph, and really to all who would encounter that Emmanuel child, who you know by the name Jesus. Though in Joseph's day, the people weren't facing the threat of invasion from a foreign army, I've come to recognize that the world is never short of circumstances in which people need saving. In fact, so far as I can tell, the whole world needs saving. The choice that Ahaz had in front of him that day near the water reservoir is the choice human beings in all ages have to wrestle with. You see, like Ahaz, a person can walk through life just playing the game, wearing some outward veneer of spirituality, and yet avoid backing it up with obedient action. One can choose to live in self-reliance, trusting on one's own abilities, one's own strength, one's own wit to face the threats that come in life. Or one can choose to live by faith in God, which isn't just the mental gymnastics of thinking the right thoughts, but actually showing real trust in God by actively obeying his voice. My friends, you have the vantage point of privilege over me, to be sure. My Emmanuel child was just an ordinary child, serving as a signpost, pointing to a God who is present and intends to save. The Emmanuel child that you know, that you think of, Jesus, was anything but ordinary. He turned out literally to be Emmanuel. He was God with you and provided salvation for the whole world and from every kind of evil. What good news! But as with Ahaz, you too need to decide how you will respond to this Emmanuel child. And by your choice, by your decision, he will either turn out to be the signpost along the road that you ignore at your peril, or he will end up being your salvation. If you do not believe, you will certainly not be able to stand. But if you do believe in him and demonstrate that belief through the concrete action of trust, then you can stand firm in all the difficulties of this life and be assured of standing yet in the world to come. So be firm and calm, my friends. Do not be afraid and do not lose heart. As it was then, so it will be always. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. But with faith, you will surely receive God's reward. So this Christmas, as you celebrate the birth of Jesus, Emmanuel, God with us, may you heed the sign. May you turn away from trust in self. And may you instead choose to trust fully in this God who is with you. And so, God, we say thank you for the gift of Jesus. We thank you for the salvation that Jesus brings. We thank you for the reminder of your presence with us that Jesus brings. God, we don't want to miss the fact that he also brings with him a choice. And that all of us, like Ahaz, have to look at the sign and make a decision. Will we trust in ourselves first and foremost? Will we go our own way? Will we depend on our own stuff? Or will we not fear and stand firm and put all our faith and trust in God? God, this Christmas, might you give us the courage and the resolve to make the choice that Ahaz couldn't make, to trust you with our whole beings. No matter what we're going through, no matter what we're experiencing, God, we declare our trust in you, our faith in you, and choose to respond to you with our entire lives. God, thank you for your goodness and for your grace, for your mercy upon us. We bless you in the name of the Emmanuel child, Jesus. Amen.